If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, welcome to Stone Cold Shows, Season 2, Episode 14. I'm Brandon Strange. I'm joined by Charlie Polillo and Josh Jordan. Read Charlie's column weekly on sportsmap.com and follow him on X at Polillo. Read Josh's work daily on sportsmap.com and follow him on X at JoshJordan975. Guys, the good news is that JV looks like JV again. And to a lesser extent, AJ Hinch still has that magic touch with pitching changes. But the bad news is a 3-3 roadie just isn't going to get it done. Charlie, we were talking before we hit go on the box here, and you noted 14 of the next 17 games against division rivals here. So if there was ever a time for the hay to get made, now'd be a pretty good time to start making it. So what are some of the things that you've seen from this team that give you some encouragement that they can take advantage of this stretch?
Well, look, with Monday night's game, the Astros are into the second quarter of the season. So it's not early anymore, but check this out. I'm going to be your one man, Mr. Sunshine. Deep trivia here. I'm not saying I can see clearly now. I'm definitely not saying the rain is all gone for the Astros. But the potential's here for bright, bright, sunny days, even if the roof stays closed. Look, the first quarter of the season, if we're grading, it's an F, right? 15-25, quadruple that, you're 60-100. But grade it at least a little bit on a curve. Through their first 40 games, the Astros played 32 of them against teams with winning records. It's 80% of their games to date. Context always matters on the numbers. 32 games the Astros have played against teams with winning records. The Seattle Mariners have played 23 games against teams with winning records. The Texas Rangers, just 16 games against teams with winning records. And to go to the extreme, the Phillies, best record in baseball, they're really good. The schedule matters. The Phillies have played six games against teams with winning records. The Astros have already played 32. That kind of stuff balances out over the schedule running 162 games. So the Astros start the week, obviously nowhere in what you'd call great shape, 6.5 behind Seattle, 6 behind Texas. But if they were in the American League East, they'd be just about dead and buried, right? 11.5 games behind the Orioles, double digits behind the Yankees, behind the Guardians. If they were in the NL West with the Dodgers, it would be over already. If they were in the NL East with the Phillies already, it would be over. Hey, in the American League West, the worst division in baseball, the Astros picked the right year to dig themselves an early ditch and absolutely be able to climb out of it. And, you know, it wasn't a winning road trip. Just as prior to that, it was another non-winning Astros homestand. But again, the schedule. They went 6-6 over the 12 games, 3 against the first place Cleveland team, 3 against a very good Yankees team, 3 against Detroit. Okay, the Tigers are meh, but they won that series 2 out of 3. And having dropped 2 out of 3 before that was not a crime. So 6-6, you know, predate that, the 2 over Colorado and Mexico. They're 8-6. In their last 14 games. So they haven't been bleeding out now for a while. I mean, they need a spurt. And you mentioned the schedule. Here's the opportunity. I mean, Oakland's been a surprise, I guess, in that Oakland hasn't just been travesty bad so far, but the A's aren't good. So the Astros, they need to take 3 out of 4 from Oakland here. Then you get a very good Brewers team for the weekend. You can get 2 out of 3 there. Then the Angels, they're worse than the Astros. Take 2 out of 3 there, a 7-3 homestand. I know the Astros have been trash going back to last August at home, but things end, right? 7-3, would that be a miraculous homestand? I don't think so. Then you go to Oakland for 3, where you have to deal with hundreds of intimidating Athletics fans. And then starting Memorial Day Monday, 4 at Seattle. And just to close out on the scheduling theme, while the Astros have a 10-game homestand, 7 of the 10 against bad teams, the Mariners have 3 with the Royals. Then they go east for 3 with the Orioles and 4 with the Yankees. I mean, it's right there for the Astros to largely reel in the Mariners by the time they go up to Seattle to just about end this month. And the Texas Rangers, who do they scare? Colorado Rockies actually are close to 500 at Coors Field. They're 9-10 at home. Yeah, well, they're 9-10 at home because they just swept the Rangers 3. So the Rangers are barely over 500. The Astros are within 6 of them. And obviously you have another chunk of head-to-head games there. So for as woeful as the Astros were through the first 40 games, bigger picture, they're in very decent shape. Johnny Nash, by the way, I can see clearly now. The rain is gone.
There you go. For me, it's about the pitching, guys. You look at it, where they are, 10 games under 500, blown 8 saves at already this point in the season. I didn't expect them to convert all of those, but if you get a high percentage of those and you're in a much better spot. I'm encouraged by Brian Abreu. He's starting to look like the Brian Abreu we remembered. He's not hiding from his fastball anymore. He's got a great fastball. He's throwing strikes. He's attacking guys early in counts and putting them away. That's what you got to be doing. It's nice to see Hader starting to get going. So I just think if they can get the pitching on track, because that's still where they're the worst. They're 28th in ERA in MLB. The only teams that are worse are the Rockies and Marlins. They have a 4.96 ERA. And it's the same thing we talk about every week with the offense. Right now they have the best batting average in MLB, but middle of the pack when it comes to run score. But I'm also encouraged seeing that they're starting to get some hits later in games, starting to put some rallies together, driving some guys in with people on base, and they're getting it from Pena and Jake Myers. Loperfido is starting to look like he might be something. Singleton, the batting average isn't good, but he's giving you some power. Mostly I'm just kind of concerned, can they get Yordan to turn back into Yordan more consistently? That's really where my main concern is. I mean, Kyle Tucker, he leads baseball in home runs with 13. He's been fantastic. So if you can get Yordan to start turning back into the guy we remember, and then, of course, Alex Bregman, guys. I used to do this with Jose Abreu last year. Unfortunately, I'm having to do it with Breggy this year. 5th lowest OPS in baseball at 534, 4th lowest slugging percentage at 264. And we were starting to think, hey, is he starting to come out of it a little bit? Well, his last 7 games hitting 207. Get this, 1 double in his past 24 games, 2 extra base hits in his last 24 games. Definitely the right move to move Bregman down in the order. It's just hopefully he'll start getting it going. And we talked about this before the show started today. We remember how bad Tucker was in the playoffs last year. I mean, he was just lost at the plate. And look what he's doing now, leading MLB in homers. Gives me a little glimmer of hope. Maybe Breggy can turn things around and get back to the Bregman we all love and remember.
The biggest issue remains stabilizing with who is in the rotation and then the performance of those guys in the rotation. Josh mentioned 28th overall in earned run average. They start the second quarter of the season with worse numbers in the starting rotation. 5.25 ERA, also good for 28th among the 30 teams because they need their better pitchers to be consuming most of the innings. Look, the Tigers offense is a joke, but Verlander was crisp with his command. So if that was a platform game in terms of building himself up and being good, solid Justin Verlander, not super duper star Justin Verlander, but coming off of getting pasted by the Yankees, okay, that was a step in the right direction. Javier, it was his first start back, so I don't want to overly penalize him for getting destroyed in the one loss in Detroit. Fromber, you just need to have pitched decently, consistently. Not a 250 ERA, sub 350 would be okay, I think. And then Ronel Blanco, you just cross your fingers, right? The ERA has been climbing, but oh so gradually because he continues to give good work every time out. But he's not going to wind up with a 2.23 ERA. What does he wind up with, 3.23? Or does he really hit a wall a la JP France in the last 6-8 weeks, especially with workload concerns that'll creep in with Ronel Blanco? And then who wins that 5th starter sweepstakes? And let's remember, the Astros are still early now into a stretch of playing 29 games in 30 days, where the plan actually was to use 6 starters. So mm-hmm. Does that include both Arrighetti and Brown? Ideally not. But I don't think you want to have a diet of Justin Verlander starting on 4 days rest at 41 years of age, right? They have a start Thursday that, to me, at this point, probably goes to Hunter Brown, unless they're thinking, okay, Javier didn't last long, so you can bring him back on 4 days rest and hope to accelerate his buildup that way. But for being 15-25, it could be a hell of a lot worse than it is for the Astros.
I wanted to jump in on Verlander real quick. what is this narrative that he's washed and some kind of bum this year? It's driving me crazy. He has one game where he gave up more than two runs this season. It was against the Yankees the other day. Yeah, he was terrible in that game and he got blasted. But let's not act like he's been terrible all season. Like I said, one game given up over two runs. And the other thing to keep in mind, he's only had five starts.
Right.
That's all. Look at the sample size there. So I know some of the advanced numbers, the fit for Verlander haven't been great. But as far as the actual, how many runs has he given up? Is he giving you a chance to win the game? We saw the strikeouts have an uptick against Detroit the other day. I think Verlander's going to be fine. And then the Javier thing you hit on, Brandon. What worries me about Javier is where the velo was in that game, hitting 89, 90. But it makes me wonder, is this a deal where he's kind of like Fromber, where he's throwing slower to make sure he's throwing strikes? Because Javier was really wild the other day. Is he taking a little off to try and get it over the plate? Or is that just what he has to give you right now? I'm going to be curious to watch his next start and see if that velo is riding around 90 again.
If so, he needs to throw harder because he was getting it over the plate. I mean, right over the freaking middle of the plate. I'm not worried about it at this point because it's not like he's coming off forearm tenderness or an elbow, right? It was a stiff neck that sent him to the injured list, but it absolutely bears watching.
It does, and we don't know what the extent of that injury actually was because of just the secretive nature of the organization, so we don't know. But it does kind of seem like the entire organization's kind of clenching, just given the fact that, you know, not just the performances at the plate, but the fact that you would rush Christian Javier back. And he's such an important piece of this puzzle. Bring him back when he's right. And you guys covered a lot of ground, so I'll try to just stick and move here with some thoughts. Josh, you mentioned Pena's resurgence, and that has just been a breath of fresh air for this team. Dusty was pinch hitting for him in the postseason last year, so the fact that this guy's someone you can actually drive in runs and move him up that lineup. Also, Jolks and Belak DFA'd over the weekend. Obviously, those moves are made to make way for returning players. And in Belak's case, he just was out of options. As you're getting these guys back, bring a Christian Javier back, and Urquidy could be on the way as well. Hunter Brown's had a rough year, but looked good in garbage time relief when Javier had imploded. Spencer Arrighetti and Brown are obviously on the margins here. Josh, you mentioned before we went on, you thought it was interesting that Brown came in for relief instead of Arrighetti. Charlie, where do you see these guys playing out? I mean, you know, obviously we have a much larger sample size of Brown. I've heard a lot of fans clamoring that they'd like to see Brown out of the bullpen since his starts just leaves a lot to be desired. Spencer Arrighetti, a lot more of the unknown there. And then Sean Dubin, we're seeing a lot more of him in leverage situations. How do you think this is all going to play out when the dust settles and this team becomes who they're going to be this season?
Yeah, I think a couple of weeks ago I mentioned ongoing auditions, you know, at the major league level with a contending team, or you believe still a contending team, not the ideal, but meritocracy between Arrighetti and Brown, with Urquidy starting to creep on the horizon, right? One, maybe two more rehab starts. Now, I'm not banking on Urquidy coming back and being just a rock-solid fifth starter. His earned run average was over five last season, but it was 392 through a healthy 2022. That would be excellent if you could get a consistent 5 2/3 innings on average at a sub-4 ERA from your number five starter. They just need to get away from these games where they just get destroyed in the early innings. The Astros have been a lousy come-from-behind team, but no team is going to make a good living coming back from 5-0 down in the third inning, from 7-0 down in the second inning. So, you know, I think they still believe, or is it more just hope that Hunter Brown can be the truth? His fastball command is terrible, and his fastball's not that good that he can just overpower everyone. And if he finds the strike zone once in a while, but he's wild high so often, he's just not polished and good enough to be a legit major league starting pitcher. I think Arrighetti also has command issues, which is why Urquidy, who does not walk guys, is going to get an opportunity. Again, where do the Astros fall in this stretch of 29 games in 30 days on using six starters, right? Because even if Urquidy comes back and you have Verlander, Valdez, Javier, Blanco, Urquidy, you'd still need Arrighetti or Brown to be that number six guy.
I'm curious to see what they're going to do. I think a lot of it's going to ride on how Arrighetti performs in this, you know, next few days here. And of course the timetable for Urquidy, but they're no stranger to this. When Verlander was getting rocked against the Yankees, it's what Charlie just hit on right there, fastball command. He was either wilder in the zone or he was a little wild off the plate, walking guys, putting more guys on base, and then missing over the middle of the plate. Fastball command is so much. It's what was killing JP France earlier in the year and sent him down. It's been plaguing Hunter Brown all season long. And everybody's talking about Espada. Does he need to be held accountable? What about the pitching coaches? But I will say this. Is it the pitching coach's fault that you can't throw your fastball where you're trying to throw it? I mean, I know they can work on mechanics and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, you're out there on the mound by yourself. And if you leave it over the middle of the plate with your fastball, big league hitters are going to crush it, man. You got to stay on the corners, and they're just not doing a lot of that. So I would like to see a little more accountability. We don't talk much about the pitching coaches. As we hit on earlier, their ERA is terrible. They're third worst in baseball. Clearly, pitching is a huge problem for this club this year.
Chandler Rome tweeted out before we got recording today the StatCast numbers on Jose Abreu, their bat tracking data, and it shows that Jose Abreu's average bat speed, 72.6 miles per hour. So he notes that would seem to back up both Espada and Dana Brown's insistence that it's still in there. I have a lot of thoughts. I'm going to tee it up for you guys. Are you buying that Jose Abreu's bat speed is in any way indicative that a competent batter still lives inside of Jose Abreu's body?
No. Look, it's a fun metric and it has some value like exit velocity. I don't care if your bat speed is Mach 1. If it doesn't hit the freaking baseball, it does not matter. I don't care if your bat speed could chop down a sequoia in milliseconds. If you're late getting to the ball, you're going to foul it off. So I don't care. Jose Altuve's bat speed stinks. Well, Jose Altuve is an amazing hitter. Jose Abreu, with this supposed still excellent bat speed, washed up until or unless he proves otherwise. And who is betting on Jose Abreu at this point, unless you love a long shot and have money to fritter away? So that he still has bat speed means nothing to me.
Yeah, and this is new. they just launched this new StatCast analytics here on Baseball Savant. My point being, like, this is brand new. Who knows if they're still kind of figuring this out. But you look at who's number one on the Astros, it's Trey Cabbage with 76.4, the best bat speed on the whole team. And 15th on the list, basically dead last, is Altuve at 68.8. So this doesn't really go with the eye test from what I see. I feel like Altuve's got pretty good bat speed. Yordan is second on the list, and then Loperfido and Pena follow him up, and then there's Abreu. So I figure as we kind of watch this develop and see how this evolves, we'll know a little more information about it. But it is interesting. It's one data point. It's not everything, but it is one data point that maybe Abreu's not recognizing pitches quickly enough if the bat speed's not the problem. Maybe it's his mechanics. Who knows? It could be a lot of different things. But we know this. That guy did not look like a big league hitter really for the last 2 years outside of the postseason. So I think if you asked a bunch of Astros fans, they kind of like what Singleton's doing, even though the batting average isn't very good. He is doing that thing that we've been hoping he would do. He's hitting for power. That was the thing last year and early in this season. We're like, where's the power? Well, we're starting to see that a little bit. So if you can at least just get some home runs out of him and he plays a pretty good defensive first base, at least compared to Abreu, it's not bad. I think you'll live with that.
Nobody hits a baseball harder than Giancarlo Stanton. When he hits the baseball, he's a 210 hitter, right? Ohtani consistently knocks the crap out of the ball. Well, he's hitting 340. That's a great hitter. Bat speed does not make you a great hitter. It's making contact with the ball, and then you get into angle of connection, what you can barrel up. Again, I don't care if Abreu's bat speed was 200 miles per hour. What's his batting average? What's his slugging percentage? What's his OPS? Bad, worser, and worsest.
All due respect to Stanton, I think Singleton's story is a lot more entertaining at this point. And when he hits a third deck homer, that's a better story just because of the entirety of his career arc and story arc to this point. And look, he walks too. He gives you exponentially more than what Abreu was giving you at first. And you were already planning on fading whatever Abreu was going to give you anyway. If Abreu was giving you what Singleton is giving you, you wouldn't be okay with it, but you can live with it. And right now, they can live with what John Singleton's giving them. And getting back to the analytics and basing your appraisal off of what some numbers tell you. And I don't want to sound like a Jeff Bagwell and say the spreadsheets don't play the game. But it is one of the things that's incredibly frustrating that I push back on when the Jake Myers truthers tweet out about how Jake Myers is a superior outfielder because of the ground that he covers and his arm velo. Those stats don't matter as much when you're misplaying balls, when you're overthrowing your cutoff man, or you throw to the wrong base. He appears to be a fantastic athlete. Those stats individually don't always add up to someone being a really good defensive outfielder or just outfielder in general. Again, I'm happy for Jake Myers. I'm not anti-Jake Myers. Whatever contributions he can give you, I think you consider like John Singleton as a bonus. It shouldn't be anything, especially offensively, should be anything you expect. Rant over with on that point. Guys, I want to pivot here because there seems to be a mole and the Astros organization. And I say that not in the rodent sense, but I say that because Bob Nightingale's had some tea that he's been spilling over the past couple of weeks in his Around the Base Paths portion of his weekly column. We reacted to some of the comments about how much the players are missing Dusty Baker's calming influence in the locker room. Now we're seeing the latest from Nightingale here from his article. The Astros plan to give rookie manager Joe Espada plenty of time to see if they can turn their season around, particularly with their pitching injuries. But two prominent players have privately expressed complaints about Espada's communication skills in recent weeks. I want to get your thoughts on prominent Astros players having issues with Joe Espada's communication, especially in a time right now in which the team is scuffling. Obviously, it's a super important role that the manager plays in balancing and juggling the big egos that you have within the locker room. And so right now there's a couple of Astros players that feel Espada's not vibing with them. Charlie, what's your initial reaction to that?
Those ne'er-do-wells, Victor Caratini and Greg Kessinger, stop your grumbling. Now, look, this is all in the shadows. We have no idea what crosses the threshold to qualify as a prominent Astro player. Is it a player who's playing horribly and naturally grumpy and let's try a little blame shifting? Or is it someone just thinking, boy, he was our buddy when he was the assistant coach. Now that he's the head coach, right, in terms of NBA terms, and he's making calls that I don't love all of them. What happened to my guy, Joe? So I don't know what to make of this other than that when the team is failing, right, if an individual is failing, this is the kind of stuff that you're going to have. I don't think Joe Espada has distinguished himself as some sort of tactical wizard, but that he has been inept and overmatched. I mean, through 40 games, he's tried 34 different lineups because too many guys haven't been hitting. So you try to mix this, mix that, move a guy up, move a guy down. I credit the effort trying to find a rhythm, try to find a stride from the jump when he said, you know what? I want Yordan up more. I'm going to hit him in the two hole and Tucker in the three hole. So when it's not going well, there's going to be grousing and bitching and moaning. If this turns into a bigger story, then I'll think there's more to it that matters.
It makes me think back of that Dusty Baker comments that Nightingale made a couple weeks ago. Like, remember about how the loss of Dusty Baker is having a negative impact on the team, and where he didn't have any quotes or any names attached to that narrative about the Astros. Like, where are you getting this from? Is it somebody in the organization? Is it a player? But he's not saying anything. And in this same article, you don't have any names attached to it. There's nothing that you can really pin it to, which is hard to believe it, but also it wouldn't surprise me. And the first name that occurred to me when I heard this was, I was like, I bet it's a Boris client, probably Bregman, because he hasn't been playing that great and they moved him down in the lineup. And then I was listening to the flagship and they had a discussion. I don't know if it's a rumor, take this with a grain of salt. I'm like Nightingale here. I don't have anything to prove this to. I just heard them talking about it on the flagship that Bregman had an issue with being texted that he was moving down in the lineup, not having a different kind of communication about that. Like I said, just something I heard on the flagship. The other player, I don't know who that would be. I was trying to think of other Boris clients. I don't think it would be Altuve. But either way, I mean, they're not playing well. It's a new manager. Some guys are going to maybe have some rumblings, but I think Nightingale's kind of making more out of this than it's really there. I think when they start playing better, all this stuff will go away. And to Charlie's point, overall, I've been pretty happy with the moves that Espot has made, not waiting too long to move Abreu down in the lineup and make some changes. And I mean, which one of us would have been like, yeah, Pena needs to be hitting fourth on this Astros team in 2024. Who would have said that before the season started? But if you look at the numbers, hey, he has one of the best batting averages in baseball. And they do talk about that pass the baton thing. Well, your cleanup hitter doesn't have to hit 40 home runs, especially on this team. They just need to keep getting on base, not hitting into double plays, killing rallies, things like that. So I like that Espot hasn't waited too long to, hey, let's try something else. This is not working. And everybody was complaining about, oh, Yordan hitting second. That's why they're not scoring runs this year. That's the big problem with the batting order. Well, you've moved Yordan to third, and he's really not performing any better, especially as of late. So maybe it's just about the guys producing when they had the opportunities and just getting your best hitters. The guys that they're hitting the best right now, get them towards the top of the lineup. And that's what Joe's doing.
When you're the manager, the one loss record is yours. And if there's not going to be some accountability for it, I guess blame in bad times, credit in good times, what's the point of having a manager? And, you know, this is the big time, Joe. You're culpable for taking some arrows slung your way. But is it on Joe Espada that through 40 games of the season, Josh Hader overall, terrible.
Thank you.
Ryan Pressly overall,
thank
terrible.
You. Thank
Yordan Alvarez had a month that it would have fit right in within the context of Martin Maldonado's hitting career. Is it on Joe Espada that season to date, Yordan Alvarez in the clutch has been for hunger, a 158 batting average, 6-for-37 with runners in scoring position, that Alex Bregman belongs in AAA the way he has played so far this season? I'm not saying send him to AAA, but he's worse than a replacement level player so far this season, right? This A series, Abraham Toro, done nothing in a couple of stops, Astros included, moved around. He's playing rings around Alex Bregman as he's splitting time with the A's between third base and second base. So, you know, if that's all on Joe Espada, if Dusty Baker or Connie Mack was the manager this year, all those issues wouldn't be there that they're all on Joe Espada. Well, then you put one over on me.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Charlie, because I was going to say, if Dusty Baker has the difference between Alex Bregman hitting significantly north of 200, then shame on Alex Bregman. And again, and I'm literally love Alex Bregman, the baseball player, so this is not an indictment on Alex Bregman. But if this is true, and we don't know, but if it's true that he took offense to the way that he was communicated, that he was and moved down in the lineup, not benched, wasn't benched, he was moved down in the lineup. If he was upset how that message was delivered to him, do you need anything other than your stats read to you to justify that move? And I'm with you guys. I like the fact that Espot is trying to do things to spur the... Do you remember last season when Jeremy Pena could not find a spot in the lineup that Dusty Baker was satisfied with? 2-hole, 6-hole, 7-hole, 8-hole, like just all up and down the lineup. But Jose Abreu, 4-hole, 4-hole, 5-hole, 4-hole, 4-hole, 5-hole. It was so incredibly frustrating the way that Dusty Baker played that last season. And look, I understand it's a delicate thing. Being a manager is about managing the personalities more. It is about the tactical managing of in-game situations at this point. But, you know, it's really the performances that have been lacking on field. It's really aggravating to hear that anyone could point to Joe Espada and say that this is in any significant way his fault.
Well, right. It's a zero-sum game. And at this point, way under 500 is the sum. But if Joe Espada is to be blamed for that which has gone wrong, foremost blame, he's the manager, so he can take some blame. But then Joe Espada gets all the credit for Jeremy Pena playing at just about an all-star level this season. Does he make the all-star team right now? Not if they take three shortstops. That Bobby Witt fell is pretty good. That Gunnar Henderson fell is pretty good. Both way better than Pena. But Pena's been great. So does Joe Espada get credit for that? That Jake Myers starts the homestand with an OPS over 800, the fourth highest OPS on the Astros roster, a better OPS than Yordan Alvarez. I guess then Espada's done a hell of a job with Jake Myers while also ruining Yordan. So it comes back to the individual player performances, right? This isn't football where if you're the head coach and or offensive coordinator, your scheme, your play calling, the talent always matters, but a more direct bearing on what happens on the field is a byproduct of plays called in football than they are the manager running out this player or that player.
I think it's interesting. We talked about this on the podcast last week about why is Bregman the only guy that can continue to perform at this low level and he doesn't get dropped in the batting order. Like everybody else gets moved around. Abreu had an incredible career and they're hitting him eighth. They didn't have a problem with that, but they didn't want to drop Bregman below fourth. And I thought it was very interesting. It was a day or two after we did the podcast, Dana Brown was on the flagship and he was asked like, why doesn't Bregman get moved down? Everybody else gets, is he some kind of sacred cow? I think was the question, something like that. And then Dana said, I could see that's Joe's call, but I could see Bregman getting moved in the batting order. That very night, he was hitting sixth. So this is something the Astros, Dana Brown, Joe Espada, they're talking about. It's nice to see, though, that Bregman isn't getting some kind of special treatment. It's nothing against Bregman. It's just perform or we're going to move you down in the order. And that's what we brought up on this podcast last week. I was like, if we know Bregman's a notoriously slow starter, and this year it's been worse than ever, why is it that you just put him in at third or second or fourth or whatever and just ride it out for a month and a half of the season every year when you know that's the trend? Why not put him at sixth and then wait for him to get hot and then move him up when his play dictates that? So I'm glad this was talked about. They're in such a bad spot this year. They are so far behind. They can't screw around and worry about people's egos or that kind of, you got to win games now. You got to put the most runs on the board you can now. You can't worry about people's feelings anymore. This season's going to be over.
Part of the problem in grappling with that is other than the way Bregman played the first quarter of the season, anybody else above him in the order, save Abreu while he was here, would be an upgrade judged by the results so far in the season. But that Bregman is 30 as opposed to Abreu 36, 37. I don't think anyone's fundamentally thinking Alex Bregman's washed up. He's just played like a washed up player through the season's first 40 games. And then who are you thinking with any sort of sustainability should be ahead of Bregman in the lineup, right? Yiner Diaz has not done much for over a month now, right? Starting the season, hey, he was a fifth hole guy. Have him ahead of Abreu. They didn't start that way, but you wouldn't now say get Yiner up into that in that five spot. Ditto Singleton, ditto Jake Myers, ditto Dubon when he's in the lineup. Possible wild card, Chaz McCormick was terrible before he went to the injured list. His OPS barely over 600. If McCormick gets back, at least against left-handed pitching, to being the Chaz McCormick of the last couple of seasons, that's a guy, at least in that platoon side of things, you could say, hey, he's fifth, drop Bregman down. But I just don't think, you know, you're not going to say, hey, Loperfido, you're the five-hole hitter. So it's been kind of Bregman by default. And so far, Alex Bregman this season, it's been a lot of fault.
Yeah, and again, we don't have any inside information, but it is curious the timing of Bregman gets moved down the lineup and then all of a sudden Nightingale gets this information about these prominent Astros players who have a problem with the way Espada's communicating with them. But what we do know is that Espada's obviously not just persona non grata with a couple of Astros players. He's been taking bullets from the fans on social media who are looking for people to blame. And another one of those people taking bullets has been Dana Brown. Dan Brown had some comments that I think ruffled some feathers when he was on with MLB Network. He said that he can't see a scenario in which the Astros are sellers at the deadline. That's drawn the ire of a lot of Astros fans. I took it as a guy who's just trying to talk a good talk for his team and show that he has confidence in them to be able to turn it around. Charlie, what were your takeaways from Dana Brown's comments? Do you think Dana Brown sounds crazy that he's not ready to just openly talk about trading players away at the deadline?
To me, it's no harm, no foul. I mean, Dana Brown speaking with the media. Behind closed doors, you know, would Jim Crane shout him out of the room? Do you want to be clicked? What do you mean we need to think about being ready to sell off? I think Dana overstated it a little bit, and that I can't think of any possible scenario where we'd be a seller. well, how about one more month of baseball like the Astros played the first 6 weeks of the season? So to just, I can't hear you. I can't hear you. Bad things. I can't hear you. I can't hear you. But I don't think it was a big deal that he said that and, you know, that he's going to come out and threaten the players. Yeah, they don't pick it up a month from that by the next month or 6 weeks. We're going to look to sell all their asses. Those without no trade clauses anyway. So I just think much ado about not much in this case. But if Dana Brown truly can't conceive of a circumstance where the Astros would be in more sell mode, I would say he has a little bit of a myopia problem. But that this season's already down the chute, the chicken little screamers and so forth, just look at the standings, the division in which the Astros are. Now, part of the fun of a fan, I believe, is overreacting to things both good and bad. It's left to saner people to sometimes stay the course. And if things don't straighten them out, then you need to alter that course. But the Astros with 120 games left in the season are quite viable.
But what's Dana going to say? I mean, it's look at the day and age we live in. Whatever he's going to say, it's going to get back to the players. It's going to get back to Jim Crane, Bagwell, whoever else. So you have to put a good face on it. And, you know, he's not, yeah, we're a disaster. We're going to get rid of it. He's not going to say that. Plus, Jim Crane, he wants to sell some tickets. When do they need to sell a lot of tickets? Hey, during the summer when the kids are out of school, that kind of thing. You don't want to be saying, yeah, we're going to get rid of Kyle Tucker. And they're not going to talk about that stuff. They're going to say it's early. This is a talented team. Eventually, they're going to play up to their talent level, and we're going to start reeling off some games. And that's kind of Dana Brown's big quote the last couple of years. Oh, eventually, we're going to win 10 in a row. And he said that for a couple of years straight. I don't know if they've quite gotten there to 10, but you know, if they win 7 or 8 in a row or 8 out of their next 10, or so, then we're talking about a completely different situation. And like Charlie said, with the division, they're not so far back in the division to where it's insurmountable. And Dana has often talked about the Braves, how they got off to a poor start and they ran down and took over first place in the last couple of years when he was there. It's not out of the question, but I just expect Dana to toe the company line. You want him to be calm. He's one of your team leaders. And he kind of goes back and forth on what he says a lot. Remember, he was like, oh, I don't think the bat speed's a problem with the Abreu. And then a few days later, he's like, yeah, we're working on some things to help his quick twitch and help his swing maybe get a little quicker. And then all this data comes out that we just talked about how maybe Abreu's bat speed isn't that bad according to the analytics. So Dana kind of goes back and forth on things. And look, leaders aren't supposed to tell you the truth. What football coaches come out on Sunday and tell you exactly the truth? They try not to give you any kind of information they don't have to give you.
Dana Brown should have just said, let me tell you a little story about the tortoise and the hare.
Yeah. And Chandler Rome made a note. I think it was Chandler who made the note about how all MLB locker rooms, they have MLB Network going nonstop. So what's Dana going to do? Just openly admit that, yeah, we're considering trading some guys away if this falls through. Should that be the case, it is not his job to communicate that to the public and everyone else at this point in the season. You're right. Leaders are not there to tell you the truth. Don't forget to vote in November. And speaking of the truth, I misspoke, and I want to make sure I am not one of these dirty liars on these podcasts. Moles are not rodents. They're insectivores. So I think on that note, that's probably a good place to end it. That's going to be it for this episode of Stone Cold Stros. If you listen on podcast and you enjoy the show, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you get that podcast. Charlie, Josh, and I will be back next week. But you don't have to wait that long to get your sports fix. All you have to do is subscribe to Sports Map Houston and Sports Map Texans on YouTube. This week on the Sports Map Texans channel, we will be reacting to the schedule release. So make sure you catch us for the schedule release reaction on Sports Map Texans. And the best way to make sure you don't miss that or any other piece of content that we put out is to subscribe to both channels. So please do that now. Charlie, Josh, appreciate your time as always. Go Stros.
And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger for the ones who get it done.